This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
We will now pivot to a presentation that is an update on a specific condition on cerebral palsy. So my introduction of Gary Noritz. He is an internist and pediatrician at Nationwide Children's Hospital and professor of pediatrics at Ohio State University. He is chief of the Division of Complex Care, interim chief of the Division of Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics, and current chair of the Council on Children with Disabilities of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He was the lead author of the joint clinical report from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the AACPDM, Providing a Primary Care Medical Home for Children and Youth with Cerebral Palsy. Dr. Noritz's talk this afternoon is entitled, Children, Youth, and Adults with Cerebral Palsy, Updates on Care Approaches. Welcome to Dr. Noritz.
Hey, John, thanks so much for having me. My name is Gary Noritz. As John said, I'm in Columbus, Ohio. I'm happy to talk to you about cerebral palsy today. March happens to be Cerebral Palsy Month, and so I'm glad to spread the word during this month to you. By way of disclosures, I've done some past consulting for Abbott Nutrition, not really relevant to what we're talking about today. The recommendations that I'm going to talk about today are consistent with the national organizations, such as the American Academy of Pediatrics, and not going to talk about anything off-label. At the end of our presentation, I'm hoping that you will be able to discuss the latest recommendations on the primary medical care of people with cerebral palsy, recognize the associated challenges that are faced by many people with cerebral palsy, and examine the interventions that may be used by people with cerebral palsy. And in order to do this, I want to walk through the definition of CP, how we make the diagnosis of CP in the current age, and comprehensive care for people with CP. So turning to the definition, and this is the most current one, and there may be tweaks to it coming from those that write these kinds of definitions, but I'll read it because to an extent, almost every word in this definition is important. CP describes a group of permanent disorders of the development of movement and posture that cause activity limitations that are attributed to non-progressive disturbances that occurred in the developing fetal or infant brain. The motor disorders of CP are often accompanied by disturbances of sensation, perception, cognition, communication, and behavior, and by epilepsy and secondary musculoskeletal problems. And with a prevalence of 3.2 per thousand, there's more than 100,000 children in the US that are affected. And so I highlighted within the definition some of the words that I think are really most important to discuss. One is that it's a group of disorders. It's not really a diagnosis as much as it's a phenotype. And there are many things that can lead to that phenotype, which we'll talk about a little bit. But it's really a grouping of people with motor disability, disorders of movement and posture. There are other things that go with this motor disability sometimes, but not always. But we talk about cerebral palsy as a motor disability. We attribute this motor disability to non-progressive disturbances in the developing fetal or infant brain. And so while the brain is still developing, if there is a disturbance such as an infection, a trauma, a malformation, a genetic problem, but it's not progressive, then that would qualify for CP. Things that are progressive, like degenerative diseases, those are not CP. And again, it's a motor disorder, often accompanied by these other disturbances, sensation, perception, et cetera. So some people with CP have them, more than the average person, but certainly not all of them have these kinds of problems. One of the ways we look at cerebral palsy is through the Gross Motor Function Classification System, or GMFCS. And so it's a nice shorthand that we use both clinically and in research to talk about patients and their motor function. And so again, just their motor function, not their fine motor function, their speech function, their eating function. We have different scales for those. But for this, we have a scale between 1 and 5 of severity of the gross motor function. And so we'll often talk in clinic about this patient who walks like a 2 or used to walk like a 2, but maybe has gotten a little bit worse and now behaves a little bit more like a 3. And the pictures here really illustrate the gross motor function. So kids that are level 1 don't have very much limitation in their activity, and they can go up and down stairs without holding onto a rail. Kids that are level 2 can do pretty well at flat surfaces, but really do need to hold on to go up and down stairs. Somebody who acts as a 3 is able to walk short distances probably without any kind of device, but any longer distance or medium distance would use a handheld device such as a walker, and for longer distance would use a wheelchair. Someone who's a 4 gets around the community in a wheelchair and may use a handheld device, but really just in therapy. And somebody who is a 5 is transported by another person and does not really have independent mobility of their own. So again, it's a motor problem. Other things are affected and often are cognition, language, social and behavior, and they're often accompanied by seizures and hearing or visual deficits. This lesion occurs during brain development, and we think we know sometimes when it happened. It could be prenatally, if we know that there's been an infection like cytomegalovirus or toxoplasmosis or the Zika virus. Certain toxins are known to cause CP, certain medications taken by a pregnant woman. Malformation of the brain that happens early in development, such as holoprosencephaly or lissencephaly. Perinatally, we think sometimes this is where it happens, that there is abruption of the placenta, aspiration of meconium, and a lot of times we just don't know. And then if there are disturbances to the brain early in development, and generally people will say that this is before the age of 2 years, an infection like meningitis, a trauma, hydrocephalus, that those would be patients with CP as well. It really is important to recognize that obstetrical complications are not a major cause of cerebral palsy. And so if you type cerebral palsy into your favorite search engine, you will be taken very quickly to websites by lawyers who want to represent patients in lawsuits against their obstetrical providers. And not that that never happens, but it's really not the major cause of cerebral palsy. And we're finding more and more that there is that there are genetic causes that underlie the problems in cerebral palsy. And I had a patient admitted to me in the hospital today who's got cerebral palsy and a new gene I never heard of that is the cause of their cerebral palsy. Let's turn to diagnosis. So why is it important? And we really are trying to get to early diagnosis throughout pediatrics of all kinds of motor disorders, CP especially. Why is this? So one of the things is that we believe, and we think we have good data now to show, that when you identify cerebral palsy early and we intervene early, the brain is still fairly plastic and the outcome can be better by training the parts of the brain that are working to take over for parts of the brain that aren't. When we look at other kinds of neuromuscular disorders, such as Duchenne muscular dystrophy or spinal muscular atrophy, we also think that it's important to find these early. And the reason that I'm talking about Duchenne and SMA and other things like that during a talk about cerebral palsy is because the primary care doctor, the first thing that we hope that they'll notice is that there's a problem with the motor system. We don't hope that they'll find the answer right away. We want them to find all kinds of motor problems and get them referred early for diagnostics and for therapies. And we want that, as I said, because it helps the outcome down the road. It also helps get them into the right kinds of therapies, into the right kinds of services, into genetic counseling. And really, and maybe above all, there's really significant family stress when the diagnosis is delayed or is inaccurate. And the families will often talk about this long and very frustrating diagnostic odyssey when they really see that there's something wrong with their child in terms of their motor development, and they can't get a firm answer as to what that is. And they see lots of doctors and have lots of tests before they get to the right one. So I was privileged early in my career to sort of stand on the shoulders of some giants and get into this motor screening in the medical home neuromotor screening expert panel. And I want to highlight just one little thing that we did here that is targeted to primary care providers. The part that you can't see is that we want, we recommend, the AAP recommends that all children be screened for all developmental disabilities at 9, 18, and 30 months at those well-child visits. And if there is a concern about motor disability, we use using this tool that we have in the this clinical report, we ask the primary care provider to examine the child and decide, do they have high tone or do they have low tone or normal tone? And if they have high tone, which is normally what you would see in cerebral palsy, we ask them to look into neuroimaging, such as an MRI. And if there's low tone, to look into CK or creatine kinase and thyroid stimulating hormone, which will help you get to the answer for the muscle diseases. But we are really focused on that top bar of higher tone and looking for neuroimaging. Another really great project that I was somehow able to talk my way into, I think, was this project that was really international in scope to define the early accurate diagnosis and early intervention in cerebral palsy project. And this was led by some real superstars in the field. And I was privileged to just represent the AAP at it. And so what you see here is a real effort to say that we should identify kids early if they have CP or are likely to have CP. And they are able to be identified very early in development. And so when I say very early in development, I'm talking about even before 5 months of corrected age. And so that's gestational age, could be even earlier than that. And there are standardized tools. One is called the Hammersmith Infant Neuromotor Exam, or the HINE. The GM, or the gross, the general movements, the TIMP, and I, at this moment, my mind just went blank as to what TIMP stands for, and these other ones as well. These are validated and defined motor, neurologic exams and motor testing that a person can learn how to do. Generally, a primary care person is not the person that will learn to do that. It could be, the people that are generally trained in this are neonatal physical therapists, neonatologists, and neonatal neurologists, or other people that take care of kids coming out of the NICU. And so there are certain, depending on the corrected age, there are certain tests that a child might undergo, including an MRI for an early child, and for a child that's a little bit later, there are other ones that need to be done. And across the top here are the things that really should clue the primary care provider into the fact that, hey, this is a child who is at risk for CP. They were born preterm. They had brain problems at birth, like hypoxia, or they're encephalopathic or having seizures. They have a history of a risk factor, such as a birth defect or intrauterine growth retardation, or being born small. And then there are other kids that, you know, sort of come out of their neonatal period without a whole lot of detectable risks, but yet they have CP. And these are the kids that often the parents will identify the concern, and the pediatrician should be able to recognize at 9 months, if a child is not sitting independently by 9 months, that could be a problem. And if they have early hand symmetry, early hand asymmetry, that could be a problem. Children are generally ambidextrous till 18 months of age. And seeing a hand preference early could alert you to there being a problem on one side of the body. Genetic testing used to be somewhat controversial in the sense of, wow, should we ever really be doing genetic testing on a child with CP? And now the question is, who should we get genetic testing on? And across this bar here, it's just the Medline search for cerebral palsy and genetics. There's just tons of new material coming out. And we have even some projects going where we think we know we think it's even pretty clear what the etiology of the CP is. And when you run genetic testing, you also find that there's a genetic problem underlying it as well. When the primary care provider has identified that at least there's a concern for a motor disorder such as a cerebral palsy, we, the AAP, have recommended three things to happen simultaneously. One is that the PCP start a diagnostic workup, usually with arranging an MRI of the brain. At the same time, referring to medical specialists who can do the specialized diagnostic testing and get them started in treatment if a disorder is found, and also refer to early intervention and therapy services. All three of these things at the same time. We don't have to have the diagnosis to get a kid into early intervention. We don't have to have a diagnosis to get them started in therapy. It's helpful when we do get the diagnosis, but because there can be wait lists for all of these things, we don't want to wait until the diagnosis is confirmed for sure, because we're missing out on important neuroplastic brain time. The care of a child with CP really needs to be comprehensive. And, you know, it's one of these, you know, it takes a village to take care of a child with CP. It takes a whole lot of people, both in the medical field and outside the medical field, working together, talking with the patient and the family to give the child and then the adult the best care possible, because it really needs to be multimodal. And so then this is the paper that Dr. Takayama referenced, which we published as a joint effort between the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy for Cerebral Palsy and Developmental Medicine. And again, sort of a privilege to lead a big group like this, many experts weighing in on this really comprehensive paper, which is available in the journal Pediatrics. And there's an executive summary available as well, which really hones down on the recommendations. But I do want to go through some of them with you. So first of all, what's the point of having a medical home for somebody with CP? Don't they just need to see their CP doctors, who might be a neurologist or a developmental pediatrician or a physical medicine specialist? And the answer is no. A child with CP is a child first and needs primary care. They need anticipatory guidance like all other children do. They need vaccines and screenings. They need care when they're ill. The neurologist is not an expert in treating strep throat or identifying rashes and that kind of thing. And that's really where the primary care provider comes in. And also really getting the child into school services, dental care, and that kind of thing. Now, the primary care person may end up coordinating to some extent between the person's other providers, who again might be an orthopedist or a physical medicine doctor. And while they are taking care of their individual pieces of the puzzle for somebody with CP, the primary care person is tasked with taking care of the whole person with CP. And when a primary care provider has a well-functioning medical home, this is what we hope they'll be able to do. There are many associated conditions with CP. Pain, unfortunately, is very prevalent, which means we need to know a lot about it and we need to work on it. Intellectual disability is present in about half of kids with CP, which means it is not present in half of kids with CP. There are speech-language problems, vision, hearing, autism higher than the population, epilepsy, and so on. This is something called the International Classification of Functioning for Disability and Health. And using this is the way that internationally we talk about body structure and function, activity and participation, which are impacted by environmental factors and personal factors. And so one of the really big things that, you know, that I've learned in my journey of doing this is that, you know, I used to think body structure and function were everything. Like, you know, if you could make the spasticity better, the child would be better. If you could make the child grow, the child would be better. If you could fix their scoliosis, that was the important thing. But really, it's so much more multimodal than that, and doctors are starting to learn this, that it's all about activity and so on. And so coined up in Canada, where they have a great center called CanChild for studying childhood disability, they've really transformed this into what they call the F words: fitness, functioning, friends, family, and fun. And these are the things we need to be working on with our patients with cerebral palsy. And that's a way to conceptualize it. And on their website, you can find some great resources for working with a child and a family around what are the things that are important to you? What are the functions that you want to be able to get to and maintain? What are the things that are fun for you, and how can we make sure that you're getting to do them? This is one of the ways we help you to get to do them. There's lots of rehabilitation interventions in the world. And the ones that are illustrated here are great, but really expensive and can take a long time to get through insurance and so on. And so it's important to get these started early when they're needed. So therapies are very important. Adaptive recreation is very important because we have people with CP who want to ride bikes and kayak or play baseball. And we want to find ways to get them to do that, even if it needs some kinds of accommodations to do it. All of these equipment and mobility aids, orthotics, home equipment such as lifts and shower chairs, there's a whole residency called physical medicine and rehabilitation to learn how to prescribe these things and find the right ones. And in the bottom right corner here, I'll show some communication devices that often patients who have verbal disability can use to communicate with their caregivers, their teacher, their spouse. And you know, we're certainly familiar with this kind of thing from Stephen Hawking. They've come a long way in terms of usability. Strengthening and tone management is something we spend a lot of time on in sort of the specialty world of cerebral palsy. And two things to recognize is that there's a motor disability for two reasons. One is the muscles are weak, but also they have abnormal tone. And these are not necessarily the same thing. And so the most common thing that we see in cerebral palsy is spasticity, or tightness of the muscles that is velocity dependent. And the faster you move the muscle, the more spastic and the tighter the muscle gets. And I think the number is about 80 or 85% of CP, people with CP have spasticity. But there are these other movement disorders as well, dystonia, chorea, athetosis, abnormal movements, and so on. And so what can we do about it? So for weakness, we can try to strengthen the muscles the same way we try to strengthen muscles in any person with resistance training. And some of this needs to be adapted. And a lot of it really is done in concert with physical therapists. Tone management is multimodal. And there are various specialists that might be involved in this, such as physical medicine, orthopedics, neurology. And listed here and in the little cartoon of the communication between the spinal cord and the muscle are where the various medications use. The ones that we see really the most are baclofen, which is an oral medicine or given by pump into the spinal cord, which acts here as the upper motor neuron is exiting and becoming the lower motor neuron going out to the muscle. Or botulinum toxin, same thing we use for wrinkles, which paralyzes the muscle slightly by interfering with neurotransmitters across this neuromuscular junction. There are other medicines that we use less often that are here as well. Diazepam or Valium is often used, especially in littler kids, and baclofen works very similarly to it. There are also surgical interventions, namely the intrathecal baclofen, which are in the spinal cord baclofen, which I mentioned. And then there's another procedure called the selective dorsal rhizotomy, where some of the sensory nerves are cut within the spinal cord, which interrupts this feedback loop, which reduces the spasticity. Hips are a very big problem for kids and adults with CP in that the tone in the hips can cause dislocation. And so if you think about the, you know, the hip being a ball and a socket, with abnormal tone on the bone, it can start getting pulled out, and dislocation can happen, which can cause pain, which can reduce the range of motion. And this is something that, you know, the CP specialists want to watch very carefully. Scoliosis is frequent, particularly in children with more severe CP. Often this is monitored and there may be bracing early in the course, but eventually spinal fusion is often needed. And because it's a big surgery and because there are common complications, shared decision-making around when to do it, if to do it, are really very important. Pain, especially in adults, is very clearly seen. Two-thirds of adults have pain from a median of 3 body sites. It's often hard for our patients to communicate pain, and their parents may say, oh, this, you know, the way they're crying, this facial expression, we think that this means pain, and we need to take that very seriously. It's under-recognized, it's under-diagnosed, we're probably under-treating it. And pain in general, we need to try to figure out where it's coming from. And I won't go through the various classifications of pain here, but there are many things that can cause pain in somebody with CP. Some of the same things that any person can have, a fracture, a tooth cavity, that kind of thing, gallstones. But there are also malfunctions of the sensory neurons, which are painful as well. We have to recognize the train. We have to treat it holistically, often using both non-pharmacologic and pharmacologic modalities. Autism is very common, more common with earlier gestational age, more common with lower cognitive ability, and it's highly associated with epilepsy, and also has a male to female predominance, like in the regular, the general population. Mental health. This is a lesion within the brain, and so it shouldn't be surprising that there are so many things that also happen within the brain that can be affected as well. And ADHD is common, learning disability is common, depression is common, anxiety is common, more common, again, than in the typical population. Sleep is a problem, and the more problems with sleep, the more problems you're going to have with all the other things that impact CP. And when we're evaluating somebody's sleep with CP, we want to look at their pain. Is it seizures that's working them up at night? Visual impairment that can interfere with the circadian rhythm, and this kind of thing. I do want to leave time for questions, so I will speed through the rest of this a little bit quickly, just to say that respiratory problems are the number one cause of morbidity and mortality. This is a patient of mine. This is her normal when she's well chest x-ray, and you can see that she does not have a whole lot of lung capacity for when she might get a little bit of a cold or a little bit of pneumonia. And so we want to do everything we can to keep her from getting pneumonia and infections and so on. Immunization is extremely important, and things that we can do to help her cough more efficiently are really important. We see a lot of constipation. We see a lot of feeding problems. Feeding somebody with CP can often be very difficult, and it's about 1 in 15 kids will have a feeding tube. And I just want to show this real quick because it actually comes out of all of your good data in California. This is a patient of mine plotted on what we would call the regular CDC growth chart. But this is somebody with level 5 CP, so somebody who's transported in a wheelchair and also has a feeding tube. And when you look at her on a graph that shows her against other people who are level 5 CP and have a feeding tube, you can see that she's really not under the curve the way that it looks here that we'd be really worried about. She's really sort of average for other kids with CP. And this is one of the ways that we can follow somebody for their nutrition. Transition, I know you have a lot of other talks on transition during this conference, so I won't belabor this, except that it's really, really important. And in adulthood, we know that CP continues. And again, most children with CP will live to be adults with CP. And this is a friend of mine, Dan Whitney, who is at the University of Michigan, who mines these big data sets out of Medicare, looking to compare people with CP to people without CP. And he's able to show that, you know, for instance, somebody with CP is almost six times as likely to have osteoporosis as somebody without CP, nearly five times as likely to have cerebrovascular disease, you know, two to three times as likely to having kidney disease and broken bones and hypertension and this kind of thing. Here are some good resources, and I believe you'll have access to the slides. Primary references for definition, diagnosis, and comprehensive care. And I am happy that I had a chance to talk to you, and I am happy to take your questions.
Dr. Noritz, thank you so much for a very comprehensive discussion of cerebral palsy. And we actually have a number of questions that have come up during your presentation. So if it's okay, I'm going to go ahead
Please.
And read them. Okay. So the first one is about the prevalence of cerebral palsy. And is that increasing or decreasing over time in the U.S.? And what about the rest of the world?
Sort of interesting and a little bit difficult to say. We do think it is finally decreasing a little bit. And so we've had an increase over time as we were better able to save premature babies. But now we're better at saving premature babies and protecting their brains. And so we do think that the prevalence is starting to come down a little bit. The three-ish per thousand is pretty common in most of the developed world. I think Australia is a little bit better than we are, maybe like two per thousand. It may be a bit of a trade-off in developing countries where they have less ability to keep micropremies alive, but they do have more brain meningitis and infections and things like that with term babies. So we think it's decreased slightly is the short answer.
So that's good news. This one is very specific. If there are hypotonia neuromuscular symptoms, so not the spasticity, but the low tone, and there is a genetic cause with a normal brain imaging, can that be called cerebral palsy, or is it considered some other developmental disability? And I think this comes up because the definition, if you have a diagnosis of cerebral palsy, that opens you up to resources that are tied to eligibility.
Yeah, I would say that somebody who has a hypotonia that we believe is due to the brain, even if the brain MRI is normal, but we know, there's a genetic, as long as it's not a degenerative genetic cause, I call those patients CP. And one thing I wanted to mention that I feel like I glossed over a little too fast is that babies, especially early babies who have CP, they're often fairly hypotonic and floppy to start with. But over the first year or two, they start getting more spastic, usually first in the limbs while they're still hypotonia in the trunk. But having hypotonia is a kind of CP in my book.
Okay, thank you. And but I guess just to clarify, would other people, is that agreeable with everybody, or would
This is one of those things we sort of debate in our societies, and it's different in other countries where the services you get are based on what you need, not what you have. And so in our country where we base the services on what you have, we're a bit more expansive in our definition. But our definition, I see that somebody says they don't think CCS will accept it. I disagree. I think, you know, hypotonia with a non-progressive motor disability, that is cerebral palsy by definition.
So advocacy. Okay.
Yeah.
Then the next question has to do with dental procedures. And there is a talk tomorrow about dental issues, but whether there are specific risks around anesthesia. And I think the key question is, you know, should this be done under general anesthesia, or could it be done in a clinic?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it kind of goes for kind of all anesthesias that a child might undergo, even if they need anesthesia to get that brain MRI the first time. I think that primary care folks are, should be, and are good at sort of sussing out, is this a kid at risk for a respiratory complication, which is usually the biggest thing that we'd be looking for. And so often it's, you know, these sort of indirect kinds of things of looking at the chest wall, looking at the respiratory effort, how often do they get pneumonia, this kind of thing. I think there are, you know, lots and lots of kids with CP, number one, who actually do great without sedation. And, you know, you'd be shocked to know that they're able to get some dental work done without sedation if you've got, you know, a good dentist and a good show on the iPad. But for those that do need sedation, I don't think that all of them need to, you know, automatically be like done in a hospital setting with anesthesia, that kind of anesthesiologist. You know, particularly kids who are ambulatory, they're much less likely to run into those kinds of complications.
Thank you. So the next question is, I think, partly related to the adult studies that you demonstrated. I think osteoporosis is higher in the cerebral palsy population.
Yep.
The question is, do people with cerebral palsy benefit from adapted weightlifting, as well as yoga and other forms of exercise?
Absolutely. And there are actually some really nice studies on like all of those things. Yoga, especially weight training. Again, you know, it's hard for a person at Ohio State to say nice things about the University of Michigan, but they got a great program up there in exercise physiology for adults with CP. And they've done great studies about improving bone density and improving cardiovascular fitness that people can do. Sometimes they need the right adaptations. Often they need help with transportation and things like that. But they really are very helpful for all of the regular reasons, as well as protecting their bones.
So we're running out of time. Maybe two more questions. So one is, any resources for adults with cerebral palsy to share with providers or caregivers, especially if they don't have access to a physiatrist or someone with that specialty?
There's two organizations that I think are in my slides that I like to point to people to. One is the CP Foundation, Cerebral Palsy Foundation. I believe it's CP Foundation. Oh no. It's yourcpf.org. And that is a organization dedicated to helping people with CP live better lives. And there's a lot of connection within that with resources. And also a program that I'm a lot more involved with called the CP Research Network, which just doesn't do research, but also has a lot of patient and family facing activities and attempts to try to hook people up with services, which we know are hard to find in different places.
And I'm going to end with a question about how to fund equipment with a goal of self-actualization as opposed to medical necessity. So things like equipment for sports, off-road with wheelchair on sand or uneven terrain, etc.
It's a great question. It's a big problem. I will say in Ohio, a lot of that ends up getting funded through Medicaid waiver kinds of funds, you know, where Medicaid will deny you to have a adaptive bike, but we're able to get you an adaptive bike if you're able to purchase it with waiver funds. That I feel like that's the most, you know, there's obviously, you know, whatever money the family has or can raise on their own. But I agree. It's, you know, it'd be great to get people all the things they need to live great lives, not just, you know, that what we would call medically necessary.
But difficult.
Difficult, okay. Yes.
Well, thank you so very much for a very comprehensive discussion.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.